Hello, and welcome to Threat Modeling Line of Business Applications with the Microsoft Threat Analysis and Modeling Tool version 3.0. My name is Andrew Law. I'm a Senior Security Consultant with Microsoft Ace Security Services. To start off with an agenda, I'd like to talk about first the definition and purpose of threat modeling, why we threat model our applications, and what value threat modeling represents to us in securing our software. I want to talk about the Microsoft SDL LOB, or the Secure Development Lifecycle for Line of Business Applications, and how the TAM tool fits into the SDL LOB process. I want to jump into the threat analysis and modeling tool itself, give a high-level description of how the tool works, but in particular, dive into the Common Task Library, or what some people will still refer to as the Attack Library, and how organizations can leverage the CTL to help identify risks in their application and prescribe actions against those risks. Finally, I'd like to talk about some threat modeling lessons from the field that we've learned within Microsoft IT, working with internal product teams, and also working outside the organization with partners developing software using the Microsoft platform. And I'll also refer to additional resources that can be referenced on additional reading on threat modeling and the SDL. So first, a little definition about LOB software, line of business software. When I talk about line of business software, it's generally not written by a product team or an independent software vendor like a Microsoft. It's usually written by IT organizations in some industry verticals, such as insurance or manufacturing or retail or financial services. Usually these businesses, their central core competency is not software development. They leverage other people's platforms, other organizations' platforms, such as Microsoft.NET Framework or Microsoft SQL Server or Microsoft BizTalk. They leverage these platforms and components to build their own software that's written specifically to help their business processes. Generally, they do go through a design phase where they design, they code, they test, and deploy. And in general, in most cases, historically, security is thought of as an afterthought. Maybe just before the application is going to be rolled out, the product team might hire a penetration tester, or in many cases, security isn't thought about until after the application is released and there's a problem, there's some kind of a hack, and project management works in reactive mode to have programmers go through and secure their code. In many cases, these types of activities are very ad hoc, they're inconsistent, they're repeated across different projects over and over again, and also security is thought of as a technical problem with technical solutions. What we're trying to do with threat modeling and what we do at Microsoft is we move threat modeling discussions around risk and around security much, much earlier to the design phases of this standard development life cycle. The idea being that the earlier you talk about security, the less expensive and the easier it is to address security issues. So that's what the TAM tool, or the threat analysis and modeling tool, when used in the context of the SDL LOB, is designed to do. It's designed to move away from unstructured, ad hoc, reactive discussions on security and make the discussions more structured, more scalable, more sustainable, proactive set of activities occurring in the design phase of the development lifecycle. So why do we threat model? Really, threat modeling can be thought of as a way of managing risk inherent in any application that we create. And when I say manage risk, we uncover problems or vulnerabilities in the application, and we decide to either mitigate, transfer, or accept the risk in those vulnerabilities. When I talk about mitigating risk, one example might be, for instance, implementing SSL if we're transferring data in the clear across a public network like the internet. That's a vulnerability. It's vulnerable to man-in-the-middle attacks. And one way we might mitigate that risk would be implementing SSL to encrypt the data going across the TCP/IP protocol. One example of transferring risk may be an application where I'm dealing with credit card transactions. Rather than write all the code myself to deal with credit cards and deal with having to protect that credit card information, I may transfer the risk to a third-party payment processing center, which deals with all of the risk inherent in dealing with credit card transactions and credit card numbers. That's an example of me transferring that risk to a third party. With acceptance of risk, there may be instances where I look at a particular vulnerability and I determine that the chances of that vulnerability being realized through an attack are extremely low. And/or I think about the inherent business impact of a particular vulnerability being realized. If the business impact is extremely low and the probability of a particular attack also being very low, I may decide to accept the risk inherent in an application. And that happens quite often. What happens usually in most IT organizations is that acceptance of risk is not documented in a consistent way. And many times, programmers or other technical people are making decisions on acceptance of risk rather than management where it belongs. So, what threat modeling allows me to do, therefore, is not only describe how I'm going to be mitigating or transferring risk and how programmers should be implementing certain technologies to mitigate or transfer risk, but threat modeling also allows me to document decisions on the acceptance of risk into an application and specifically document that for management sign-off. Threat modeling provides a structured, repeatable, and sustainable approach to the acceptance or management of risk, I should say. In the development process. Many times the decisions on how managing risk are made behind closed doors, by the water cooler, in conference rooms. They're not documented very well. Threat modeling allows me to document that in a structured way and also allows me to take previous threat models and apply them to new applications, so I'm not restarting the discussion on risk from scratch each time. What threat modeling also allows me to do is create a central communication mechanism for all members of a product development team, not just developers and systems administrators, but also for management, for testers, for users, for business analysts. It's a central mechanism for all communications relating to risk. That includes security, privacy, business continuity. Anything that has to do with risk associated with that application, I can store in a central threat model for that application. And it allows me to translate technical vulnerabilities, like, say, SQL injection or cross-site scripting attacks, into their business impact. So, for instance, I might have a SQL injection, and many developers know how to talk about SQL injection, but many managers won't really understand what that is. What I can do in the threat model is translate SQL injection to a business impact, such as loss of proprietary information. So all people, all members of a development team, from management to developers to testers and users, are able to look at a threat model and think about it in terms of risk. So IT, when we talk about IT security and we talk about application security, security is always a balance between people, process, and technology. And many IT organizations spend quite a bit of time training their people on security through awareness programs. They spend quite a bit of money and resources on technology trying to keep up with all the latest types of attacks. But they don't spend an enormous amount of time on process, on repeatable process. Again, most of the people and technology pieces of security are done in an ad hoc method. This was also true to a certain extent at Microsoft, which is why over the last nearly 8 years, we've spent a significant amount of time developing a process around application security. We call that the SDL, or Security Development Lifecycle. The Security Development Lifecycle is a set of mandatory steps or procedures which occur at every phase of the development lifecycle at Microsoft. These activities are documented in our SDL documentation on public blogs, which I'll give a reference to at the end of the session. But they prescribe activities which occur at training, requirements, design, implementation, verification, release, all the way through response. There's a set of security-related activities which must take place before a product can be released. What we've done with the SDL LOB is the SDL LOB is a could be thought of as a variation or an implementation of the SDL, which is specifically targeted toward line of business applications that are built in IT organizations. The SDL process was created for product teams at Microsoft or independent software vendors creating prepackaged products such as Microsoft Vista or SQL Server or BizTalk or Exchange. The SDL LOB is a variation of the SDL targeted at people creating line of business applications. It's very, very similar, but again, targeted specifically to meet the needs of IT organizations using other people's tools or other people's platforms and components to build business applications which help their particular business. Threat modeling for both the SDL and SDLOB optimally fit in the design phase of both of the development life cycles. The idea being that you discuss risk, the way you're going to mitigate, transfer, or accept risk before even a single line of code is written. Now, that's optimally. I want to stress here that just because threat modeling fits into the design phase of the development lifecycle doesn't necessarily mean that you cannot do threat modeling after something's been released. In fact, there are product teams, not within Microsoft, but outside of Microsoft, who have legacy applications that may have been written 10, 15, 20 years ago, could be written with hundreds or maybe even millions of lines of code that are subsequently hacked. Now, the team developing that application has an option of going through and reviewing hundreds of thousands or millions of lines of code, but in many instances, because of limitations on resources, they're unable to do that. What these teams will do is threat model the legacy application, which allows them to focus their efforts and limited resources into areas of the application which represent the most significant risk to the company. Perhaps they threat model and try to narrow down components of the application that might deal with, say, credit card processing or dealing with personally identifiable information. And instead of reviewing all the hundreds of thousands of lines of code, they focus their efforts on components which represent the highest risk to the organization. Now, once again, fixing bugs after something has been rolled out is obviously much more expensive than fixing problems and addressing issues in the design phase. So again, optimally, threat modeling takes place in the design phase of both the SDL and SDL LOB. The TAM tool that we're going to be using, we're going to be talking about, is intended to be used in the design phase of the SDL LOB. What I did want to talk about is some of the similarities and differences between threat modeling and SDL versus threat modeling and SDL LOB. Both represent a sustainable approach to security in the design phase, and they're both designed to be structured and repeatable methodology for understanding threats to your system and also for managing risk. And both communicate mitigation, transfer, and acceptance of risk in a consistent way for all members of a team, both from management to testers to developers to users. Here are some of the differences. I've listed the SDL and SDL LOB. A typical target for threat modeling in the SDL is ISV software, or independent software vendor software, such as Windows 7 or SQL Server, or components and APIs that are going to be used by other people to build applications. The SDL LOB is really targeted at IT business applications like claims processing or inventory or financial processing. These groups use other ISV components to build their applications specific for their business. In the SDL, typically when I'm doing threat modeling, I don't really know what types of data I'm using in most cases. So for instance, if I'm threat modeling Microsoft Excel, I don't know if Microsoft Excel is going to be storing recipes or it's going to be storing secrets to a new nuclear reactor. I don't really know. Whereas in SDL LOB, I usually have well-defined types of data. I know, for instance, if I'm doing a claims processing application for an insurance company, I know I'm going to be dealing with claims and payment information and reserve information and insurance type of data. In SDL threat modeling, I usually approach threat modeling using something called DFDs or data flow diagrams, and I'm able to show the major components of my application and how different data flows across trust boundaries between different components. The SDL LOB uses a different approach and uses business use cases. Again, it's targeted at business applications, so we describe in the TAM tool exactly how data is flowing across different components in different business situations. The SDL threat taxonomy uses something called STRIDE for their categorization. They categorize threats using the STRIDE methodology, or STRIDE stands for spoofing, tampering, repudiation, information disclosure, denial of service, and elevation of privilege. SDL LOB uses a more simplified approach, just CIA, confidentiality, integrity, and availability, to categorize the threats and address them. Now, typically, the SDL is driven by a security engineer. And there's in Windows 7 or SQL 7 or SQL Server, we have full-time security engineers assigned to those initiatives, and threat modeling is usually driven by a subject matter expert for security. With IT line of business applications, in many cases, because of resource constraints at the company, there isn't the budget or the resource for a full-time security engineer. So the SDL LOB threat modeling tool and the TAM tool is designed to be driven by the development team, the architects, usually the business analysts with help from programmers, but usually architects, business analysts, and project management drive the threat modeling activities using the TAM tool. And security engineers might be brought in on a consulting basis to review or to help with that. But the one of the primary goals of the TAM tool that I'll be showing was that most of the threat model is done by people without a lot of security expertise. So let's look at the steps involved with the SDL LOB threat modeling using the TAM tool. The first is to classify and identify our assets. What it comes down to, again, in business applications, when we're talking about security, we have different types of data. It all comes down to the type of data that we're using. Some data is public, and it doesn't, the business impact to losing public data may not be very high. Some other types of data might be high business impact data, maybe social security numbers or financial data. It's those what threat modeling allows us to do is identify and classify those different types of data so that we can make decisions on risk depending on the relative impact that a successful attack would have on different classes of data. Once we've done that, we want to identify our components. A component might be a browser, a SQL server, an IIS ASP.NET application server, a BizTalk server. Identify all the components at a high level to our application. I want to identify my roles and my services inherent in my application. What types of users are there? What types of background services are running? Then I want to define my application use cases. I want to show how the data flows through the different components of my application and is used and accessed by different roles and services. Now, based upon that, now all of that has been done. Those first four steps can be done without any security engineer. That's the way the TAM tool is designed, is that we don't need security people to do classify data, identify components, identify roles, and define our use cases. And what we've done within the TAM tool now is our security engineers have created a common task library, or some people still refer to it as the attack library, which helps to automatically generate threats and available mitigations based upon the use cases that I've created in my threat model. And I'll show you a demo of that when I show the tool. Then I'm going to do something that the tool can't do, which is classify and rate the threats. I want to think about based upon the threat, the chances of that occurring, that particular attack occurring, and also rate the potential business impact that a potential attack would realize to my organization if it were made available. Now, finally, after I finish rating my threats, I want to make a decision on whether or not I'm going to mitigate that threat with a particular technology, again prescribed in the CTL, whether I'm just going to transfer that threat to another group or to a third party, or finally, if I'm going to accept that threat. And that mitigation, transfer, and acceptance of threats is communicated to all of the different people involved in developing the application. Mitigations are communicated to developers or to network administrators, and transfer and acceptance of threats is communicated to management. So when we think about attacks, we think about all of these. We're all hearing about them every day. We have everything from brute force attacks to SQL injection to cross-site scripting. And basically, what Microsoft has done in the TAM tool is taken all of these different types of attacks and put them into something called the CTL, or Common Task Library. The Common Task Library is just a set of XML files stored out in the roaming directory after you install the TAM tool. And it can be broken down at a simplified level into three types of files: attacks, tasks, and attributes. Attributes are things like that can be applied to a component, a role, or a service within your threat model. It might include something like C++. If I'm developing a component, I may write that in C++. So I would assign an attribute to that component in my threat model. Another attribute might be SQL. If I have a service which accesses a Microsoft SQL Server database, an attribute of that component would be SQL. What I also have, obviously, are attacks. The Common Task Library includes a list of all the attacks that we have seen over the years at Microsoft, both inside the Microsoft organization and with our partners. And we've developed a list over time of all of the different kinds of attacks that we've seen. Finally, what the Common Task Library does is it links tasks which are required to mitigate the attacks that are inherent in components which are given certain attributes. So if I have a component, for instance, that includes an attribute of C++, then I automatically know that that component is susceptible to buffer overruns, and that one way to mitigate buffer overruns is to make sure that I validate the input. Another example might be a component which uses SQL to grab data. As soon as I see that a component is using SQL, I know that it's inherently susceptible to SQL injection. And one way to mitigate SQL injection is to use parameterized queries. And you can also take this and extend the Common Task Library to other types of attributes. For instance, here I have an example of a component using authentication. As soon as I introduce authentication requirements to a component, I know that authentication module might be susceptible to phishing attacks. And one way to mitigate phishing attacks is by implementing two-factor authentication. So that's what the Common Task Library does at a simplified level. It's just a set of XML files out in the TAM directory of the roaming profile, which helps me to link or map components with certain attributes against attacks which are inherent for those attributes, and then prescribe a list of tasks which can help to mitigate those types of attacks. Now, there doesn't have to be a one-to-one relationship here, and the CTL architecture is designed to be extensible. For instance, I've created attributes here, just op different operating systems. I might have a component which is implementing different operating systems using Windows 2003, Windows 2008, or even Novell. This isn't Microsoft specific. Each one of those operating systems, regardless of manufacturer, is always susceptible to different types of viruses or worms. And different tasks which might help to mitigate virus or worms attacks can be listed in the CTL as tasks, such as implementing patch management from the different vendors, always running with the absolute least amount of privilege required to get a job done, and you could even put physical tasks in there, like making sure that the server room is locked and not accessible. Here I've brought up the new TAM3O threat analysis and modeling tool. Before I start to model, create a threat model, I'd like to show the task library that's built in to the TAM tool. This is the common task library, or CTL, that I referred to earlier in the presentation. In previous versions, it was referred to as the attack library. Basically, what you can see here is Microsoft has created a list of basic common types of attacks that we see every day in Microsoft IT and in our product groups. We've populated the CTL with this list of attacks. As you can see, for instance here, I brought up the cross-site scripting attack. The tool shows a brief description as to what cross-site scripting attacks are about. If I open up the tree here on the left, I can see also that the common task library includes common mitigations for cross-site scripting. For instance, here's a mitigation for cross-site scripting which calls for encoding HTML output using the anti-cross-site scripting library from Microsoft. There's a new version out called version 3.0. Down here, I can see where this type of technology is usually implemented within my ASP.NET code. I also have more information about specifically to programmers, some sample code on how exactly I would implement the anti-accesses library, and I also have references for additional reading about cross-site scripting. So here's another example down here, a man-in-the-middle attack, description about what man-in-the-middle attacks are, and one possible mitigation might be using HTTPS. Here's some information about how I might do that, or using IPsec. It's important to note that this is not a comprehensive attack library. It's a basic set. Many of our programming groups and many of our external partners who use this tool have extended the attack library with additional types of attacks and additional mitigations. It's designed to represent a base set of mitigations that other groups can leverage by adding their own types of people, process, or technology solutions as they see fit. So again, this is all just XML in the CTL. Okay, so now that I've explained the task library and how that works, I want to talk about a basic threat model here. When I first start doing threat modeling, I want to start at a high level describing what it is I'm modeling. So I go into the threat model and put a basic brief description from a business standpoint. Again, this is for line of business applications. So I want to describe here basic business objectives for the application that I'm using. I might put in a few business objectives, just describing what it is that I'm doing and why it's important for me from a business standpoint. Then I want to start to decompose my application into its member parts. So first I'll start with roles. From a user standpoint and from a service standpoint, I want to put who are the people that are going to be using this. For my threat model here is just a basic insurance claims processing type of application, and I might have a claims adjuster here and a claims manager. And what the tool's asking me to do is just put a brief description as to what the user is, and it also has some attributes here. This becomes important later on. These are the same attributes I talked about when I described the CTL. I can assign any attribute I want from the CTL here. This is an authentication attribute, and I'm saying that this claims adjuster is using forms-based authentication. For my claims manager, I'm saying that person uses Windows integrated Kerberos authentication. This is what helps later on when I generate threats automatically. These types of attributes help to associate certain weaknesses or vulnerabilities with my threat model. So this is basically the mapping. These attributes map my threat model to the common task library and help to automatically generate the threats and potential mitigations to my threat model for my users. So you'll see these attributes throughout my threat model. I've also created a set of service roles here. These are things like SQL, possibly a SQL process, which inserts data into my database. Here I've set up three services. One is a batch reporting service. This batch reporting service, at the end of the day, collates and summarizes data for my managers, and it uses Windows integrated authentication. Here I have an IIS ASP.NET type of application which serves a pro service which serves up my ASP.NET web pages. Once I've done that, created my user roles and my service roles, I want to go and describe my data. Now, this is the cause of a lot of confusion with many people who are first starting to do threat modeling. A lot of people I've seen, if they have 300 tables, will put 300 data elements in here. And that's not what this is about. We don't want to recreate our conceptual data model here. What I'm trying to do is classify the different kinds of data that are being used in this application. And when I say classify, I mean in terms of their potential business impact, the negative business impact, if the data is lost. So many times I might only have three or maybe four types of data in any application. Even though I might have 300 tables, that could be classified into maybe three or four types of data. At Microsoft, we use LBI, MBI, and HBI, or low business impact, medium business impact, or high business impact. Low business impact or LBI data might be public data that's published by my marketing department or by my salespeople. It's data that it's important, but if it were lost or stolen, would represent a relatively low business impact to my company. Maybe high business impact or HBI data might include data that has social security numbers or credit card numbers or other or maybe people's personal medical information or other PII, personally identifiable information in there. I may want to classify that. And then MBI, medium business impact data, might include things that are competitive information, that maybe price breaks or my the types of how quickly it took me to pay out a claim for on a particular insurance policy. It wouldn't be high business impact, but it certainly wouldn't be something that I want my competitors to see. That might be medium business impact. This is very subjective. The tool can be modified so that, again, it's just a text file. But here I've created three types of data. My claims data, for instance, I might batch together as one class of data. You can see here that includes something like claim number, claim details, my payment histories and reserve history. That may be something that might be classified as MBI or medium business impact data. My customer data, however, you'll see includes things like social security numbers and account numbers. That may be classified as high business impact data. And product data, it's just a product ID and description, maybe a type of auto insurance that I sell or a type of property insurance that I sell. That might be LBI, low business impact, or relatively anonymous data. And later on, you'll see the reason I classify this data is because depending on the impact that the loss of that asset represents to my organization, that may change my decision on whether or not to mitigate or accept risk. If I have high business impact data in my threat model that is compromised, I may decide to implement something like IPsec to mitigate that data. That same type of threat, however, might be present for low business impact data, and in my threat model, I may decide to accept that risk. It all comes down to the value of the data to your organization and the potential negative business impact. That's what determines whether or not you mitigate, transfer, or accept risk in your threat model. Once I've done that, I want to go in and create and define my basic components. So in this application, it's relatively simple for demonstration purposes. I just have a browser, a web application server, and a SQL server. You'll notice that when I define these different components, you'll see these attributes again. So for instance, this is a web application, the browser. It's using HTTP. There's other technologies that are being used here. Again, each one of these are help me when I go to generate my threats, help the common task library to know what types of attributes are indicative for the use of each component so that attacks can automatically be generated. Once I've done my application decomposition, and you'll notice that all the work that's been done, creating roles, creating data, creating components, up until this point, doesn't require any security expertise. I don't need a security engineer to do this. I can have my users or even my project managers or my programmers, my business analysts do this type of work. And that holds true also for the next section. Probably the most important part of creating a threat model is creating my use cases. My use cases define how the data that I defined up in the first application decomposition step, how that data is being accessed by roles and what components it's flowing through. So for instance, here I created a basic use case here, which is a claims adjuster reading claims information. And as I create this use case, which is done through these three steps here, a Visio document is automatically created, which allows me to see a visual representation of my roles and my data flowing through the different components of my app. So a claims user reading claims information is broken down into three steps. First, the claims adjuster enters the claim information to the browser. And I can see here in my use case, I can define what data is flowing in this particular use case. Once that occurs, the browser then posts the request to the web application server, and the web application server then posts the SQL select statement query to the database. That all makes up a single use case. Now, again, what a lot of people will do mistakenly when they're doing threat modeling is they'll believe that every use case, every business use case, has to be put into a threat model. So if there are 100 different use cases, they'll put 100 use cases into the threat model. Really, most threat models that I see only need maybe a few or maybe half a dozen individual use cases in the threat model. And this is because what we want to do is not document every use case, but document every type of class of data going through every component. So this is why data classification is so important. For instance, once I show how HBI data is going through my claims adjuster role, my browser, my web application, and my SQL server, once I've done that, I don't need to do that again for every type of LBI data. The only time I need to add a new use case is if I have a new component, or I have a new class of data, or I have a new class of role. So just keep in mind that when you're doing these application use cases, you just want to cover all the different classes of data. That's why it's important to keep your data classifications to a minimum, maybe three or four. And once you've shown how that data flows across different components, you don't need to add a new use case. Some customers I've seen, they might add a button to a screen and then create a new use case for that button. Well, the data classification and the component and the technologies remain exactly the same, so there's no reason to create a new use case just because you change around the look and feel of a screen or add a new button. One example maybe for creating a new use case could come if you were adding a new set of technologies. Say I had an existing threat model and someone wanted to access the application from a mobile phone. In that case, I'm using new technologies which have new vulnerabilities and new attributes, so I need to create a new use case for the threat model. So once that's done and I've created the use cases and I've created my application decomposition, I can go in and I can generate threats automatically. What that does is it generates threats based upon the CIA taxonomy I talked about earlier. And what it does is it reads through the use cases and the roles and data and components that are part of those use cases. And then from the attributes that I've defined in my application decomposition, a calculation is made linking those attributes to what is built into the threat library, or task library, excuse me. And threats are automatically generated. So for instance, here, I can see that there's unauthorized use when I'm using the browser from the internet, because there's different kinds of vulnerabilities inherent in that. The browser is using HTML, it's using a network protocol across in clear text across the public network. There's all kinds of authentication weaknesses that I have to be concerned about. But basically, these threats are automatically generated for me. What I can then do is I go into each one of these threats and I can start to subjectively, again, the tool's not going to do this for me automatically, I can subjectively think about the impact and the probability of this occurring. And again, we use just low, medium, and high at Microsoft IT. These are just drop-down text files and people use their own risk ratings. But I can say, for instance, if there's a SSL threat or a cross-site scripting threat, I can say the impact of that, because I'm using claims data here, would be high. That would result in claims data being lost. And the probability of that also might be high. Again, this is very subjective. But what I can do with that particular threat that was generated, let's just say this is a cross-site scripting vulnerability I'm worried about here, I may decide that I need to mitigate that risk. So I'll say I want to reduce the chances of that happening. I can put a little comment in here as to why I want to do that. But down here, the tool automatically created a list of possible mitigations for this particular vulnerability. So what I'm going to do here, the task items, these are coming out of the CTL, is I'm going to say I'm going to perform context-sensitive HTML encoding using the anti-cross-site scripting library in order to mitigate that risk. Here may be another type of risk. I won't go into detail here, but I may decide that the probability and the impact of that, given the type of data that I'm using, is extremely low. So I may decide I want to accept that risk for this rollout. And what's important, again, about the threat modeling tool, it doesn't just show how I'm mitigating risk, but also it points out in red here that I've accepted some risk. So all managers can take a look at this threat model. And I've noticed a lot of managers want to review what risk has been accepted. And in some cases, that's overridden. And initial decisions to accept risk are overridden by management. Who feels that the risk needs to be addressed. So here I'm saying accept the risk. I might put a reason, chances of this happening are extremely low. What's important now is that can be called out in a threat modeling discussion and documented. Perhaps I might want to attach an email here describing discussions that we've had about this acceptance of risk. What's important is the mitigations, the acceptance, the transfer at risk is all documented in the threat model here. And this threat model can then be distributed to the team, to programmers through a set of reports here. The programming report will show to the development team exactly how to code the mitigations we've documented in our threat model. The risk owner's report might show all of the different levels of risk and what risk we're accepting into the application. Again, in general, you can create your own threats if you like. You need to use the CTL. You can manually go in and create threats if you want to and assign different types of task items to different risks. Now that we've seen the threat modeling tool in action, many people question who best in the organization should own a threat model? Should it be the application team or should it be the security teams? In general, what I find is best is for the threat model to be owned by the group of people who are the closest to the business application, which in most cases are the business analysts, the architects, and the project management. They work together to build the threat model. They're going to know when business use cases change on a regular basis or when their data changes. So it's best for them to own the threat model. In general, security subject matter expertise can be brought in to help review the threat model when it's complete, make sure that mitigations and acceptance of risk are consistent with the policy and best practices for the organization. What I've also seen is application teams sharing their threat models. What you find is once you've developed a threat model for a particular type of application, in many cases, the threat models are very similar for other applications that are created, as long as the data types stay the same and as long as the components and their attributes stay the same, threat models can certainly be leveraged across different development teams, so you don't need to create threat models from scratch. Now, in general, however, the CTL, the Common Task Library or Attack Library, is created and maintained by subject matter experts. So what subject matter experts will do is they'll go in and modify the CTL to meet the specific needs of the organization. They might add threats, they may remove particular mitigations, they may add their own mitigations or their own specific custom code samples. But security subject matter experts go in, they keep on top of new zero-day attacks that are occurring. They may attack the common, they may modify the common task library to reflect new types of technologies that are coming out seemingly every day and the associated vulnerabilities and mitigations that can be applied to those new technologies once they're introduced to the organization. So in summary, the TAM3O has evolved from many years of experience threat modeling line of business applications. The TAM tool, again, is optimized for integration into the security development lifecycle for line of business applications. And it's really streamlined to not impact existing development processes as much as possible. What we don't want immediate subject matter expertise to be have to be required to do a threat model. We want business analysts and architects to be able to create a threat model and then leverage the common task library to automatically generate threats. And if a subject matter specialist or consultant is required, it will only be required after a significant majority of the threat model has already been created. But again, threat modeling using the TAM tool, it represents a structured and repeatable and scalable approach to managing risk. A threat model is all about managing risk and communicating in a consistent way your decisions on risk across all levels of the product team, from management to developers, to testers, systems administrators. Anyone who works on that project can reference the TAM threat modeling tool to discuss and understand risk. Additional information on the TAM tool can be found out on our ACE team blog, and information on the SDL LOB, and all the work that's being done by the Trustworthy Computing team at Microsoft can be found, again, in our SDL blogs and our SDL site. Or you can contact me, Andrew Law, alaw@microsoft.com. Thank you very much for your time.